okay.
Everybody, it's Mark and Denise in the mornings here on WWDB 860 AM. I'm Denise Clay, and if you're watching us on Facebook Live, you notice that I am sitting here by myself today, and that's because Mark Kelly Tyler is somewhere where he can't communicate with us today. So we're kind of hanging out, you know, doing the show, but I'm not, I'm alone in the studio, but I'm not actually alone because my guest co-host, Janice Armstrong, columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News and Philly.com, is with me. Good morning, Janice. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not bad. Not bad. So, you know, thank you so much for, you know, agreeing to, you know, get up this morning and join me here in the studio and stuff. I appreciate it.
Well, I'd say it's my pleasure, but after last night, I'm still sort of tired.
Yeah,
late night.
I can understand. Last night, Janice and I were both at an event where Dorothy Butler Gilliam, the first African American woman to be a reporter at the Washington Post, was talking about her book, and the name of the book, well, to tell you.
Oh, I have it right here. It's Trailblazer.
Yes.
And the first part of it.
Yes, it's called
Trailblazer, a pioneering journalist's fight to make the media look more like America.
And
it's a memoir, and it's a memoir, and it's fantastic. I picked it up over the weekend, started reading it, and really couldn't put it down. It tells, you know, I'm probably a columnist today because of Dorothy Butler Gilliam. You know, I grew up reading her work, and especially her columns that started in the 80s, and they were like must read in Washington, D.C. And I remember when my mother was getting used to the idea that her daughter was going into journalism, she says to me, you know, maybe you'll be a columnist like Dorothy Gilliam. And I was like, oh, no, not I. I couldn't do something like that. And she said, why? I said, well, I'm not that opinionated. And she said, oh, I think you are. And that was really the first time I actually thought about ever being a columnist. And years later, here we are.
And, you know, just listening to her last night, some of the stuff that she was saying about her early days and how that, you know, how that all transpired and some of the stuff that, I mean, she couldn't even get a cab to go on assignments.
Can you imagine?
Because
you're
black.
In the newsroom competing with everyone else. Your editor says, hey, there's a fire or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you got to get there with the quickness. Mm-hmm. And you're out, the white reporters are out hailing cabs and you're raising your hand and the cabs won't stop for you.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I mean, in the days of Uber, we forget how hard it was for folk. You know what I mean?
That's true. We do, because we kind of take certain things for granted.
And she couldn't eat in the cafeteria. Like, she had to eat at Shoals, something called Shoals Cafeteria, which I understand, I think there was one in Philadelphia. But, you know, the other reporters would be at restaurants. They could go with their editors. But she couldn't even go with her editor out to eat in a restaurant. Most restaurants in D.C. Why? Because they didn't serve black folks. You know, and this is the 60s. This isn't the 50s. This mm-hmm. isn't the Deep South. This is D.C.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in D.C., and it was the kind of thing I heard about, but, you know, I hadn't experienced it. By the time my parents were there, they didn't experience that. I guess they knew not to go, where to go and not where not to go.
Mm-hmm.
But you forget that happened there. I do. If I do, I can't imagine what this new generation, they must forget it, too.
Well, yeah, because it's not something that, you know, is in their field of vision. It's not something that they have to deal with. It's like people like Dorothy Butler Gilliam, you know, went through those things so you wouldn't have to.
Yes,
and it was really great seeing her last night. But it wasn't just, you know, getting the chance to see Dorothy Butler Gilliam. It was, you know, the chance to see folks like Michael Days, who, you know, who's trying to, you know, kind of follow her work at Philadelphia Media Networks. And I got to see Beverly Williams last night.
You know, it was great seeing her. First mm-hmm. of all, I stood and stared at her. And then it took me a while to place. And then I grabbed her by the arm and I said, now I remember you. And she smiled because she knew. It took me a second because I hadn't seen her in forever. She looked great.
She
it was
did.
So good to see her.
And she walked up and, because I had met her at the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists gala. Because we honored all the pioneers and you know, early members of PABJ. And she remembered me from that time, and she walked up and gave me a hug and asked me, you know, what I was doing and how, you know, what kind of work I was doing and how it was going and everything. And the whole time I'm standing there, I'm like, that was Beverly Williams. I grew up watching her.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I mean, the only other time that I felt that way about meeting someone was like when I got out of college and I was doing a story on an event for the Tribune and I got to interview Edie Huggins.
Oh, wow.
And that was incredibly cool. She also gave me the one piece of advice as a journalist that I have always taken since. And because when I sat down to talk to her, the first thing that she said was, "Where's your tape recorder?" And, you know, I was a print journalist, so I didn't think, you know, to carry a tape recorder with me all the time because I wasn't doing radio anymore. And after that, I had a tape recorder on me at all times because
That's
I did not
good.
Want Edie Huggins rolling up on me saying, "Where's your tape recorder?" Because that I didn't want that feeling again. So, you know, it's amazing that so much of journalism's history occurred here in Philadelphia, particularly for journalists of color.
Right. One of the early chapters of the Association's Black Journalists started here, wasn't it? Isn't
mm-hmm.
that correct?
Philly is one of the founding chapters of NABJ.
Yes, I think the actual first one was in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And then it spread, yes.
But here's the thing. People will argue about that. I've seen people actually, like, have arguments about what was the founding chapter. And I'm like, don't we have that written down somewhere?
I'm sure Walter, there's a guy in NABJ who's the historian.
Wayne Dawkins.
His name escapes me right now.
Wayne Dawkins.
I'm sure Wayne can clear that up. And what about last night when we were talking about the whole Mumia Abu-Jamal chapter, the latest, I mean, like, Dorothy Butler Gilliam, the author of Trailblazer, who was the guest of honor last night at the African American Museum, was talking about how she was president of the National Association of Black Journalists. The year we had the convention here in Philly, it was 1995, and Abu-Jamal was they were talking about executing him during the national convention, executing a former president during the convention. And she talked about how what a controversial tense time that was.
Yeah, because I remember being in, like, because the Philadelphia, because PABJ had a meeting to discuss this. They called it an emergency meeting to discuss what was going, you know, what could be done about this, because MOVE was talking about shutting the convention down.
As well, they should have.
I mean, MOVE,
something like that had happened.
Yes, MOVE was talking about shutting the convention down, because they said if you can be a group of black journalists and sit there and watch as one of the former presidents of this chapter gets executed, then we're going to shut it down. And anyone who...
And you know what? They would have been right.
Oh, yeah.
And I was the chapter president at the time.
That's right, you were.
So, in so over my head, I didn't know what was going on. I was like, what? Trying to host thousands of black journalists in Philly, throw a big meeting, convention. There were so many elements to pull together. And then there was this. This is the most important thing, because we're dealing with a potential loss of life. I don't know how we got through that, but we did. And I'll never forget it.
Well,
and I think all these years later, this, you know, not, what has changed?
Well, with the exception of Mumia being on, not being on death row anymore, probably not a whole lot. And I think that's the sad part of it. The fact that, you know, we've come so far and yet we haven't come far at all. Like, part of the research that I'm doing for when I eventually go back to graduate school is looking at political reporters and trying to find out why there are not more political reporters of color covering the White House. And, you know, part of that is just due to the business itself contracting. But I know there are other things that are going on here, and I kind of just like to know where they what they are, so that maybe we can deal with them and make it so, you know, the at least the White House press corps reflects America.
Wouldn't that be awesome to see?
Well,
I think it's partly because it, you know, these are such plum assignments, and like nowadays, most papers might have one reporter in D.C. if they have any. They, you know, we're so reliant on the wire services. And if you don't work for the wire.
Yeah, but, you know, but I also think it's a matter of who gets these assignments to even, you know, be put in the running for that. Because if you're not getting that kind of experience on the local level, getting to do it on the national level is like next to impossible. So, you know, I just want to find out why that is. I mean, I have my own theories about it, but but when you're in academia, they kind of want you to bring the proof. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to do.
Well, I'd be very interested to see what your research shows. I got my theories as well.
Well, you and I had talked a little bit about, you know, bringing on some of the folks who are competing for the 190th state rep seat, which used to be occupied by Vanessa Lowry Brown before she went. And she, well, for those of you who don't know what's happening in the 190th, the 190th is currently, you know, not unoccupied, because Vanessa Lowry Brown, who was the state rep representing that district, lost her seat due to pleading guilty, due to being found guilty of corruption charges. And when you're found guilty of corruption charges, you have to leave. So right now, that seat is currently unoccupied, and trying to find someone to run for it has been an interesting process.
It certainly has been. It certainly has been. And the election is next month.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. So the special election is next month. And I'm pretty sure that all people know about is the controversy that surrounded the seat, which was, you know, you had one person who was trying to vie for the seat but he didn't actually live in the district. And there was another person who was trying to vie for the seat, and for some reason that didn't work out. And, you know, now, right now, we're trying to figure out who's going to actually be in that position.
Yes, yes. Well, they got a very interesting, the Democrats have lined up a very interesting candidate, Movita Johnson-Harrell from the DA's office. She was the head of victim services, formerly the founder of the Charles Foundation. Mm-hmm. And she's the Democratic nominee. And meanwhile, we've got Amon Brown, who's running as an independent candidate there as well. Amon. Have you met Amon?
I have not.
Very interesting person. I was calling him Amen, but it's actually Amon. His father, I think, came up with the name when he was a young man in Egypt. And I think Amon has a brother named Pharaoh. But very impressive. He owns a daycare business, kind of a community center in town. He is actually Vanessa Lowry Brown's pick. I don't know if I should go so far as to say her protege, but they ran into each other, I think, a couple of years ago at a Walmart. Vanessa Lowry Brown told me this, that she was buying some clothing and other supplies for some relatives she was taking in. And when she went to bring up her purchase, her card was declined. And she was, you know, that awful feeling that happens. And so she was saying she was going to go out to the parking lot and call the bank and try to get to the bottom of whatever it was. And as she was turning around, preparing to leave, someone behind her stepped up and paid the bill. And the clerk told her, "Hey, your things are paid for." She said, "What? What?" And they said, "You can take it. The man in line paid for it." She said, "You know, I'm a member of, you know, I'm a state representative. I can't just have people buying things for me. Mm-hmm. I need to know who it was." So that's when Amon Brown stepped out of the line and identified himself, that he had been the one who helped her with the purchase. And he told me later that he did it just because he saw a woman in trouble and wanted to help her out. And they struck up a very fast friendship, and he began to assist her on various projects, and they became close. And when her time was coming to an end in the state house, she said she wanted him to take over her seat. But, you know, it doesn't go like that. There has to be an actual election, and he did not get the Democratic endorsement. So instead of just waiting or trying again another year, he decided to run as an independent.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more of Mark and Denise in the Mornings with my special guest co-host, Janice Armstrong, from the Philadelphia Daily News, columns with the Philadelphia Daily News and Philly.com, in a moment.
Thanks for listening to Mark and Denise in the Mornings. And Denise, thanks for holding it down while I'm out today. I want to also thank our special guest host and all of you. Listen, as you know, we're in the middle of a funding campaign to keep Mark and Denise in the Mornings on air. If you don't want this to disappear, I suggest you do something about it. Find us at GoFundMe. Look for Mark and Denise in the Mornings or hashtag Mad in the Mornings. We're not mad at you, just MND. Hashtag Mad in the Mornings at GoFundMe.com. And contribute whatever you like. Also, you can find us on Cash App or PayPal at Tyler Made Media. And if you are old school and you just want to write a check, you know, so-called check is in the mail, go to P.O. Box 25843. Again, P.O. Box 25843, Philadelphia 19128. Address it to Tyler Made Media, LLC. Thanks, you all. Keep on listening.
And we're back. This is Mark and Denise in the Mornings, and I'm Denise Clay, who's usually here, and Janice Armstrong, who is filling in today for Mark Kelly Tyler, who my usual co-host. We were having a little difficulty with her Skype line. For those of you who have seen, like, where there's been occasions where I haven't been in the studio, I've usually called in via Skype, meaning that there's a computerized app that we use to, I guess, simulate phone conversations. And sometimes Skype works pretty well. Sometimes not so much. And this is one of those not so much times. And
Do you want me to call in over a regular phone line?
Well, no, I thought you had already done that. So, but no, you're fine.
Okay.
But we have on the line one of the candidates for the 190th district, Mavita Johnson Harrell, who has worked in victim services for the DA's office, founder of the Charles Foundation, and someone that if you've never sat down and talked to her about why she does what she does is really very interesting. To hear from and, you know, brings a perspective that maybe we need in the State House where our gun laws are Swiss cheese. Good morning, Ms. Harrell, and welcome to Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
Good morning, Denise. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I didn't realize that you were running for this office until Janice Armstrong, who's also with me, kind of told me you were. What made you decide to do that?
Good morning, Janice. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning, Mavita.
So, Denise, initially I had interest. Well, I ran back for the seat in 2016. And I had interest in running for the seat because I've seen that our legislators don't effectively carry our voice to Harrisburg in many instances. So when it came up that Vanessa was probably going to be vacating the seat because of a conviction, I began to gauge interest in the party selecting me as the nominee. So when I realized that they were, well, first, I kind of had an issue because we only have 24% of the legislature that are women. And I had gotten it that they were going to, their selection for the nominee was actually a man. Mm-hmm. So because I am a Democrat, because it is part of the process, I said, oh, well, guess it's not my time. I'm doing great work at the DA's office. So I made a decision to not change parties, to stay at the DA's office, and to continue to do the great work that I was doing there. It wasn't until two candidates had already been bounced off the ballot, or rather taken from the selection process, and I received a call gauging my interest in running for the seat, that I decided to throw my hat in the ring.
So what has that process been like? I mean, is there a lot of campaigning involved? Because there's only like two of you, and two, it's a special election. I often wonder about the amount of campaigning that you actually get to do, or the amount of, you know, sharing your vision you actually get to do with folks in your area.
Denise, it has been a lot. So there are four people in my race. There is me. I am the Democratic nominee. There are two independents. One is Amon Brown, and another is Pamela K. Williams. And then we have a Republican in the race who is Michael Harvey. Now, while this district does vote 97% Democrat, I am not taking for granted, just because I'm the Democratic nominee, that I am going to have a walk to the polls. I have a late head start to this race. The other two candidates have almost a two-month head start on me, and I had to jump in with both feet. I got the call to gauge my interest on January 25th. I had to immediately quit my position at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office and prepare myself to jump in this race. It's been a lot of campaigning, showing up at events, meeting with the ward structure, door knocking. It's been a whirlwind for the past 3 weeks.
So this special election is coming up, and I guess what would you consider your platform to be?
So while many people know me as the gun lady, my observation is that the problem is so much bigger than the gun, right? We have a failing education structure. We have lack of economic opportunity. We have lack of community development. So we need to do a myriad of strategies in order to prevent community violence. We have to empower our young people. We have to make the streets safe for our seniors. We have to fix the crumbling infrastructures of our schools. We live in a promise zone. We need to fix these dying. We have business districts in the 190th that are literally dying, that we could rejuvenate with community partners.
And I guess, how are you hoping to do that in Harrisburg should you get there? Because the legislatures, well, having covered it from the Western Pennsylvania perspective, let's just say they're interesting people.
Absolutely. So I think a couple things sets me apart from the other candidates in this race. Number one is I have a proven record of not just community service, but bringing resources to the community. That's number one. As the founder of the Charles Foundation, I created a model called the Philadelphia Cares Model. My model was approved for $1.6 million, which I took that model to the DA's office, and it created 15 additional jobs. That's number one. I brought that money from Harrisburg. Number two, I have relationships in Harrisburg. I was invited to caucus about 3 weeks ago, and it was amazing. When I walked in the room, I knew half of the caucus. People are excited about me coming to Harrisburg. They're excited about my voice. One of the things is that I know some of our legislators in the West, but they've never heard my voice on the House floor. And I think I carry with me most of the values and principles and struggles that the people in the 190th have experienced. I have relationships with Republicans where we have worked on gun legislation together. So one thing that is to my benefit, as opposed to the other candidates, is I will not be the typical freshman in Harrisburg. I have relationships. I've already brought money home. I've worked with Republicans, and I think we can get some work done. Is it going to be difficult? Absolutely. But at least I already have allies who are excited about me coming up to push agendas.
Okay. Janice, did you have any questions?
I certainly do. You know, I'm familiar with your background. Could you sort of talk a little bit about what got you involved in activism and that your whole backstory?
Absolutely. Thank you, Janice. So I've been a co-victim of homicide pretty much my whole life. On Easter Sunday, March 30th, 1975, my father was murdered in front of my family. I was 8 years old. My mother has really never recovered from that tragedy. My father died in her arms. And back then, there were no victim services for communities of color. We were expected to pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and move on as best as possible. And my family attempted to do that. And my mother struggled with dual diagnoses. She struggled with severe depression, and that was devastating to my family. And then many years later, on July 3rd, 1991, my only brother was murdered over a girl. So my mother lost her husband, and then she lost her son. And it was, once again, we had to pick ourselves up and dust ourselves off. The trauma was never addressed. The pain, the PTSD, none of that was ever addressed. And I had to go on about the business of living my life. I had gotten married. I had begun to have children. I was pregnant with my third child. My brother had no namesakes. I named my last two children after my brother. My brother's name was Charles Johnson. I named my daughter Charlene Johnson. I named my son Charles Johnson. My son Charles was born about 14 months after my brother passed away. So I went on about the business of living my life. I come from welfare and food stamps and public housing. I dropped out of school at 28 years old. Excuse me, I dropped out of school and went back to school at 28 years old. I got not a GED, a high school diploma. I spent the next 7 years full-time in school. I graduated in May of 2004 from the University of Penn with 5 degrees, raising 4 children and working 2 jobs. So I know the grind. I know how to do it.
Did you say 5 degrees, Movita?
5 degrees.
Wow.
I know the grind. I know how to do it.
That's a huge accomplishment, but go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
So it's okay. I created a business in the process, and I went on about the business of trying to raise my children as best as I possibly could. And you know, there's always that one family in the neighborhood, right, Denise, where all the kids gravitate towards. We were that house. My kids fixed bikes and electronics. We rescued dogs. We had the basketball court. We would rent 15-passenger vehicles and shove people's kids in. And sometimes this would be the kids' first experience with sand. And we did this because my assumption was if we could raise the community, then my children were safe. And in the summer of 2007, my boys were 14 and 16, and they came to me and they said, Mom, we know 9 boys murdered.
Wow.
And when my boys left my bedroom, I turned to my husband and I said, it's time to go. I was successful. I could have left long ago, but I made a conscious decision to be that family in the neighborhood. But with the threat of my black sons being murdered on the street, I said it's time to go. Less than 6 months later, on January 15th, I moved my family to Lansdowne, Delaware County, 20-block radius, dry town, everybody know everybody dog's name. And I thought we were safe. And on January 13, 2011, someone walked up to the car that my son was putting in, sitting in, waiting for his sister, and put four bullets in my son. My baby, Charles Andre Johnson, 18 years old. We found out that my son was killed in a case of mistaken identity. The day before, two boys had an altercation over a girl. They thought my son was the boy coming back to retaliate. My son was there to make sure his sister was safe. And they put four bullets in my son. So you know what I tell people? You can't move away from the problem. Exactly 3 years to the day I left Philadelphia, I buried my son. So you can't move away from the problem. So I came back to Philadelphia to try and help fix the problem. I created the Charles Foundation. Charles is an acronym for Creating Healthy Alternatives Results in Less Emotional Suffering. I created that foundation 3 months to the day my son was murdered. I bought a resource center in Philadelphia. I have not received any federal or state money to do anything with my foundation. I've done it all from the muscle out of my pocket. We do summer programs. We do a Be the Change program where we identify kids mostly at risk to kill or be killed. I pay them to come and participate in my program to receive self-esteem building, conflict resolution, mentoring. I bring in people like Commissioner Sylvester Johnson and rappers that I know because kids want to see people that they can touch, somebody that they might see on TV and that they feel like they're so far removed from them. We have a community food cupboard. We do co-victim events four times a year. Look, I'm Muslim. We do an annual holiday party where we bring in co-victims of homicide. It's a therapeutic event because my son's only child was born 26 days after he died. Wow. And I knew eventually that this child was going to begin mourning. And I knew there were so many other children who had lost parents and siblings and grandparents who mourn. So I bring them together for therapeutic activities to show them that they are not alone. That eight-year-old we are raising, me and my husband are raising. So this problem touches, it has tentacles in our community. And we live with trauma, and we live with post-traumatic stress disorder, and somebody has to step up to fix it. And I'm willing to do that.
Wow. I mean, I knew about, because I interviewed you a couple of times and had talked to you about your son, but I didn't know that, you know, this had been so much of a part of your life. I now better understand a lot of what motivates you.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm not unique. I'm not unique to these issues.
And I think that's what's saddest about it. The fact that there are so many groups out there that specifically deal with mothers and families who have lost someone due to violence. I mean, particularly in the city of Philadelphia.
Or the fact that so many people in that district have had, and all around the city, have had their lives similarly scarred and touched by violence. I mean, it's so many people who've had similar experiences. This should be the number one priority in Harrisburg, and it is not.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just.
So I'm up for the fight. I'm up for the challenge. And I have a very good knack of making friends. And I plan on making some of those partners on the other side of the aisle my friends. So we can get some real work done. It's not about a fight. Because guess what? The Second Amendment, this isn't a Second Amendment fight. I'm registered to carry. I'm licensed to carry. This isn't about the Second Amendment. It's about the Constitution. All of our children, no matter where they live, no matter what color they are, no matter how much money their parents make, all of our children have a constitutional right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That's true.
And to be safe and secure. And not have to worry about some of the things that are on the minds of these kids today. I mean, my heart really goes out to them. And I admire you for what you did and what you tried to do in the district attorney's office and victim services.
Thank you, Janice. You know, I was part of the focused deterrence strategy from its inception. We had a six. I don't care how much controversy that program created, which was pretty much all politics. We had a 60% reduction in homicide in the first year.
Is that program
so what
still
I could
available?
Not do, that program, so David Kennedy, who created that model, that was one of the things that I was working on when I left the DA's office. And here's the thing. I still have a wonderful working relationship with the DA's office. I am still doing work out of that office as pretty much a consultant, an unpaid consultant. But that's something that we are really working to see about recreating and rejuvenating.
So if people want to find out more about you, about your campaign, and just generally, you know, how, you know, want to learn your story or hear your story and want to, you know, find out how they can do more to help you with with your victim services work or just know what, you know, you hope to be able to accomplish in Harrisburg, how would they do that?
They can go to my website. It's www.electmovita.com. Again, that's www.electmovita.com. They can call our campaign office at 267-730-9101.
Okay. And I'm sorry. Go ahead, Janice.
I'm sorry, Denise.
That's okay.
You know, I wanted to ask you, Movita, a lot of people don't know about this election that's coming up. How, you know, can you just sort of remind people when it is and because I think a lot of folks don't know it's coming up, and it's coming up quickly.
You're absolutely correct, and that's why I'm trying to touch as many voters as possible. So we have a special election for the 190th Legislative District for a vacant seat. That district runs from City Line Avenue, a portion of East Falls, the Ridge a portion of Ridge Avenue and the 33rd Street corridor, and a small portion of Strawberry Mansion. It goes over southward to Larchwood Street, and on the east and the west is very gerrymandered, but it's Powelton, West Powelton. It's a small portion of University City, and on the west side of the district, it goes over, it's very gerrymandered. It goes over to 55th Street and 60th Street. So you can always go to the Committee of 70 to see the map. But this special election for the 190th Legislative District will be on Tuesday, March 12th. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. I am the only Democrat on the ballot, and I really encourage everyone to come out and vote because that's one thing that happens, especially in special elections, Janice. You know, we don't know that they're going on. So I'm trying to touch everybody that I can to have them come out and cast their vote. Again, that special election is on March 12th.
Wow. Okay, well, thank
March 12th, that's just around the corner.
That's just around 20 days.
Yeah, because it's like late February now, so I guess you're really going to be on the campaign trail up until the last moment.
Yeah, up until March 13th, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, thank
you. I hope people come out and vote and make their voices heard because this is how democracy works. People got to come out. People got to vote. They got to be engaged. They got to be involved, and they got to know. Because I think there are a lot of folks don't even know. They don't even know that Vanessa Lowry Brown is no longer their representative. There's a lot of that, you know.
Really?
Sure
if she were on the ballot, they would probably vote for her.
Yes, oh, yes. Well, she win with like more than 95% of the vote, even though she'd
99.
Already won,
yeah.
What percentage did you say you just, I lost it? The call
99%.
Dropped. Did you say 99? I keep asking because I cannot believe my ears.
Yes, yes. 99% of the vote.
Okay, so let me get this straight. Your state rep is convicted of a crime and is about to have to resign, and yet 99% of the vote went to this person.
Yes.
Okay, everybody, the special election is March 12th.
We need to wake them up.
And you need to go out and vote for some people who can actually, you know, represent you because they're not incarcerated or convicted of a crime and thus cannot serve. So, thank you so much for taking the time to call in, Ms. Johnson. I really, Ms. Harrell, I'm really.
Please call me Movita, Denise.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, Movita, for calling in.
Thanks, Movita.
And
thank you, Denise.
And we'll be back with more of Mark and Denise in the Mornings in a minute.
Thanks for listening to Mark and Denise in the Mornings. And Denise, thanks for holding it down while I'm out today. I want to also thank our special guest host and all of you. Listen, as you know, we're in the middle of a funding campaign to keep Mark and Denise in the Mornings on air. You don't want this to disappear. I suggest you do something about it. Find us at GoFundMe. Look for Mark and Denise in the Mornings or hashtag Mad in the Mornings. We're not mad at you, just MND. Hashtag Mad in the Mornings at GoFundMe.com and contribute whatever you like. Also, you can find us on Cash App or PayPal at Tyler Made Media. And if you are old school and you just want to write a check, you know, so-called check is in the mail, go to P.O. Box 25843. Again, P.O. Box 25843, Philadelphia 19128. Address it to Tyler Made Media, LLC. Thanks, you all. Keep on listening.
You know, I hear this ad, and I think to myself, do people still write checks?
Yes. Yes, I was standing in line at the grocery store behind a woman who was writing a check. And it was like everything I could do to say, what are you doing? Like, not to say that, just to be quiet and let her write her check slowly. It drove me nuts.
Because when I started when I opened my most recent bank account, I didn't even ask for checks. I mean, I pay a lot of my stuff online. And I was like, well, I'm not even going to, you know, bother getting checks because I don't send checks and I don't write checks. So they would just sit there in my office as, you know, yet another one of those things that, you know, gather dust among the entirely too many pieces of paper that I have. So I personally don't write checks. But if you would like to write a check to support Mark and Denise in the Mornings, we would truly appreciate it. I will, if you're listening to us on or watching us on Facebook Live, the link to our GoFundMe account is available. I'll be posting that in a minute. And if you want to, you know, throw a few bucks to help us out, you have the option of PayPal, and you also have the option of the Cash App, which is my new favorite way to pay people because it's infinitesimally easier than PayPal on some levels, and it's, you know, a little bit more direct, and I kind of like it. So if you want to use that, that's terrific too. Now on the line, we have another one of the candidates for the 190th district seat that's going to be, you know, participating in the special election on March 12th. We have Amon Brown, who is running as an independent for that seat. And Amon, thank you for joining myself and Janice Armstrong from the Philadelphia Daily News and Philly.com on Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing
good
wonderful.
Good morning.
So
thanks for having me call in.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. I guess my first question, actually, I have like a two-part first question. What made you decide to run, and what made you decide to run as an independent?
So, all right. So, I'm a lifelong Democrat, but under the circumstances and under the Democratic Party's their rules, they chose someone else to be the nominee and not myself. So, you know, the community, they still wanted me to run. So they said, Amon, just register as independent Democrat and we'll vote you in. You know, so the community spoke and I listened and I'm on the ballot as an independent Democrat, the Amon Brown Party.
You have your own party. Well, excuse me.
I have my own party. Yes. So
how's that going? What's that process been like? An independent running in the 190th. What is that like?
It's been an amazing experience. As I'm encountering thousands of people, we're starting to see that, you know, people, they're awake now and they're not interested in a Democrat or a Republican or an independent. They want to vote the right person in. They're tired of looking at titles. They just want the right person with a good heart and with the right intentions and who genuinely care about the community. And that's who I've been all my life. I think it's time for titles to go out the window, and it's time for us to start voting in the right people. And it's going to start with this race on March 12th. And that's why the community, the whole district, they label me as the constituent's choice. So I'm riding down the street. People are like, oh, they go to the constituent's choice. And it's like a whole movement in West Philly. There's a lot of positive energy. A lot of the churches are building a faith wall around this campaign, and we've been protected. And it's, like I said, it's an amazing experience. And, we receive the phone calls and all kinds of offers to get out of this race, but we're still in it, and this makes us work harder to make it through March 12th.
People have actually been offering you stuff to drop out?
Yes, yes. We ignore it, and we just keep pushing. Because that's not why I'm running. And if something like that was accepted, I wouldn't be who I say I am. I have thousands of people believing in me and what I stand for. I'm not in the business of letting people down.
Okay, so what would you describe as your platform? I mean, if you go to Harrisburg, what are the kinds of things you're going to take on? What are you going to do?
So first and foremost, I'm a strong believer in, everything happens for a reason. And like I explained to several people, this whole Ayman Brown being a politician thing, this is new to me. But the right people in my life and even strangers, they said, hey, we would love for you, love for our rep to be you. And it was happening over and over and over. So, with that being said, if I take what they say and I actually listen to it in the beginning, I have to listen the entire way. So I'm going to be that representative that's actually in the community, listening to what the issues are, seeing what the issues are, and then myself and the constituents, we build my platform together. Each part of the district, everyone's issues are not the same. Like in Winfield Heights, they don't have housing issues or food shortages over there. But then if you look in another part of the district, like Mill Creek, there's several issues with housing and quality education centers and schools. I'm actually going to be the people's voice. I'm going to be in Harrisburg speaking for them and the direct issues. So for my first 100 days in office, I'm going to be hosting weekly or biweekly town halls in these communities and listening to what's going on, because I'm out there every day, but I'm not in it enough to actually experience what's going on. So that first 100 days in, they got me. 12 hours a day, I'm going to be in these communities, seeing what's going on, meeting with these families in their homes, in their rec centers, in and out of everywhere, every part of the district, in the alleyways. Let's build this district together, because I can't do it alone, and that's where I stand.
I don't know if I necessarily want to be meeting people in alleyways, but, I guess it can work.
Hey, that's what the district needs. They need someone young and with the energy and who has the courage to actually do what it takes, and who's going to, who's going to listen to them. They're tired of being told who to vote for. They're tired of being told what they need. It's time for us to speak for ourselves and say, no, that didn't work for us. This is what we want to do. This is what we're going to do, together. So.
Ayman, could you tell us a little bit about you? I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry. I was just thinking about your background. And can you tell people who might not be familiar with who you are, where you come from, where you grew up, and about some of the experiences you told me about that happened to you on the corner. And
okay, you know what I'm talking about. So I'm 31 years old. I'm born and raised in West Philadelphia. I went to Hamilton Elementary School, and then I went to Sarah Middle School when it was middle school. I graduated from Overbrook High School, 2 years of college. My background is in community service. I work with children. I own a few child care facilities. I currently own a community center called Overbrook Beacon, 156 in Lancaster, where we offer a wide range of support services to seniors, children, families in need. And it's all free. And we give back through that community center. But where I'm from, you know, I was raised by a single mother of seven. I'm a victim of gun violence. I got, I was shot in 2004 or 2005. I was shot in the back. By the grace of God, I survived it. And that happened on 56 and Market, where I'm from. You know, so these are the families, and these are the people that, you know, I'm running for. I'm running for the people who've been in these situations. I experience the good and the bad. And that's what I feel as though Harrisburg needs. The district needs someone who's been through a lot, you know, not just speaking on behalf of what they heard or what they seen on TV. You know, I've been through it, the ups and downs, the light and the dark. But yeah, so I'm heavy in the community. I'm not going to stop. My organization, we've been doing the work, and this opportunity here presented itself, and myself and the community sat down and said, hey, it's time. It's time for change. You know, so myself and my team, young, progressive, interested in making the difference. We've been in the streets all day, every day. I'm getting out the word. That's why I'm just getting my voice back. You know, we've been knocking doors and speaking to people, and they're excited. You know, they're like, this is what the city needs. Someone said it's like a breath of fresh air, and that we're breathing life back into the district. You know, so. Excuse me.
That's okay.
So you've really been out there talking to folks, and that's what you said. You almost talked your voice away from so much talking. And now we've got you doing it first thing away. In the morning.
Yeah, I did talk it away. And I actually was on the radio show with myself and other candidates. And I could barely speak. I was in there struggling. You know, so, but I'm back now.
So
I'll be out there today.
So what makes you stand out? Because apparently there are four people running for this seat. We just had Mavita Johnson Harrell on shortly before you came on. What makes you stand out?
What makes me stand out the most is my relationships with the community, my relationships with the actual people who need the resources. And also, you know, my loyalty, my honesty, all of that stands out the most. I don't have a laundry list of, you know, skeletons in my closet or a bad history of whatever you want to call it. You know, I've been working hard for the community, staying in a positive light. And then this moment is here, you know, and who better but someone who has the time and who can actually put 2 feet in, don't have to worry about their personal issues and the district issues. When I get in there, it's going to be all about the district and the issues. It's not going to be 2 days over here and 3 days over there. It's going to be 100% time, energy, and all about the community. That's the difference. Well, you know, I don't have, go ahead.
No, I was just wondering if so. Are you going to keep your business if you win?
Yes, my business is they function on their own. You know, they're structured to where, you know, I'm there once a week, if that. You know, because I'm in the communities. I'm actually bringing in and seeing. That's what I'm saying. I'm doing the work now. We're reaching out to families, seeing who need our assistance, and then the seat became available. You know, so I actually applied. I applied for a job because I was like, I need more stuff to do. I applied for a job at the airport so I can travel.
Okay.
So and then this happened. It's like, look at God. You know, so it's like, you know what? And you have the time, the energy, and you have the voice. You people like you. People love you. And being in this position, it's going to change the dynamic of the city, because it's going to be someone who the whole city see every day. People wonder, like, oh, they like, all we know about this man is he is a good person. And now they're starting to see, like, wow, we know him. We've met him. We can vote for him. You know, people my age, they're excited about this. You know, it just feels right. It's the right thing to do. And I know the district was expecting, you know, just super voters or seniors to come out to vote on March 12th. They'll see it's going to be more than just seniors. We're bringing out all ages. I had my announcement on February 2nd, and we had over 180 people in attendance from ages 18 to 85. I mean, the room was filled. It was standing room only. You know, so March, and they all lived in the district.
Oh, well, that's important.
And a lot of the people, I submitted, I think, 1,600 signatures. A lot of them were at the announcement. They got direct invites as a thank you. Who signed my nomination papers to get me on the ballot to even get, you know, voted for. We reached out to them. And a lot of them been coming through, and they've been volunteering, knocking doors with us. You know, so people, they understand, and they're just excited to be able to elect someone or vote for someone who's not forcing them to. This is something that the community want. They want to feel good about who they're voting for. And I'm that choice. I'm that choice for them to push the button for me. And then they can walk out the booth smiling and not wonder or not assume what they're going to get. They know it again, honesty, loyalty, and they can trust me as their state representative.
Okay. Now, if people want to know more about you and about your campaign, how would they go about doing that?
So we have a website, friendsforamonbrown.com, and then my social media, we're very active on my Facebook and on Instagram. We're very active on there. People are directly to us. They leave a comment, or they send messages, we're right back at them. People are sending us messages, hey, I want to meet you. And then they meet us right at the office, and then we talk. And then they leave, and they want posters, they want car magnets, they want all the literature we have, and they want to spread the word. And then we follow up and go to their block. Next thing you know, we have Armin Brown posters on 17 houses on the block. And they did that because they want to. You know, so block by block, family by family, we're taking our community back. And we're going to start by doing that on March 12th, voting for Armin Brown,
okay,
the independent Democrat.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Mr. Brown, and we really appreciate it. And we're going to be keeping an eye on the March 12th special election just to see how everything shakes out.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Ms. Armstrong.
Okay, good talking to you. And have some tea with some honey and lemon for that voice of yours.
And a shot of brandy.
Oh, yeah. A shot of brandy.
And rest it if you
no
can.
No brandy until the 13th.
Okay.
That's a long ways off now.
Hey, I gotta stay focused. They're trying to get us out here. So we got to stay on our P's and Q's, as they say.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming.
190, that's a tough watch.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is, because
I want everybody to watch it, because it's not being advertised. My campaign, we're like the only people actually advertising that there's a special election. You know, with our billboards, we have 8 billboards now. We just added a new one, and it has the date on it, biggest day. So people were like, what election? So now everyone's calling around saying, what election is this? Now that, like I said, they're awake now. So the 2,000 or 3,000 that was expecting to come out, easily 5,000 to 7,000 on March 12th.
And with you running as an independent, turnout is going to be key for you.
Turnout is going to be key. So the people you've been coming in contact with, they know what to do when they go in that booth. They're not just going to push straight Democrat, straight Republican. The people that are coming out on election day, they know what button to push. They're going because they know who they want as their state representative. And they're not being told. They're not allowing them to be told or forced to push any button. They want the constituent's choice. So that's and the results will show on election day.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll be back with more of Mark and Denise in the Mornings, with my special guest host, Janice Armstrong, columnist from the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. Philadelphia Inquirer, Daily News, and PhiladelphiaPhilly.com. There's so many things. We'll be back after this break.
WWDB Philadelphia, 860 AM.
You're listening to Mark and Denise in the Morning on 860 AM WWDB, a part of Beasley Media. Mark and Denise in the Morning is a product of Tyler Made Media, LLC.
Thanks for listening to Mark and Denise in the Mornings. And Denise, thanks for holding it down while I'm out today. I want to also thank our special guest host and all of you. Listen, as you know, we're in the middle of a funding campaign to keep Mark and Denise in the Mornings on air. You don't want this to disappear. I suggest you do something about it. Find us at GoFundMe. Look for Mark and Denise in the Mornings or hashtag Mad in the Mornings. We're not mad at you, just MND. Hashtag Mad in the Mornings at GoFundMe.com and contribute whatever you like. Also, you can find us on Cash App or PayPal at Tyler Made Media. And if you are old school and you just want to write a check, you know, so-called check is in the mail, go to P.O. Box 25843. Again, P.O. Box 25843, Philadelphia 19128. Address it to Tyler Made Media, LLC. Thanks, you all. Keep on listening.
Good morning, and we're back with more of Mark and Denise in the Mornings. I'm Denise Clay, and joining me today is special guest host, Janice Armstrong, columnist with the Philadelphia Daily News and Philly.com. And thanks so much for joining me, Janice. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure.
And if you would
interesting conversation this morning.
Oh, it has been, because you know, he's right. You know, we don't really talk much about special elections, and we need to, because sometimes we end up getting people elected to office in special elections that you're like, who thought this was a good idea?
Exactly. Exactly. And in all fairness, we need to mention the other candidate that's running. I think they said there are 2 more candidates who are running.
Yes.
And it was Pam. What is her last name?
I'm looking that up right now. And I'll have that for you in a second. But
and if she's listening, she should call in.
Well, yeah. If actually, if you would like to call in, if you live in the 190th district and you've been hearing from candidates, or maybe even not hearing from candidates who are participating in the special election to fill the house, the state house seat that represents your district, please give us a call. We're at 888 888- 888-329-3306. That's 888-329-3306. Or even if you're not in the 190th district and you just want to talk about the fact that, you know, basically these seats are pre-chosen by ward leaders, and that's not necessarily the most democratic thing in the world. You know, if you want to talk about that or anything else regarding special elections or stuff that you see in the news, please give us a call. 888-329-3306. And I got distracted, so I didn't look up the 190th district seat that I had said I was going to do. So now I'm doing that.
Okay. And a lot of interesting political news this week. How about Daphne Jenkins Goggins getting the endorsement from the Philly GOP to run against Mayor Kenney? I mean, that's my favorite story of the week.
Well, and it's an interesting story because she is a African American woman who describes herself as a Trump supporter, and she's gotten the
she's a hardcore Trump supporter. She loves herself some Donald Trump.
Wow. So
yes. She wants that border wall. She lines up with him on practically every issue. And I met her in 2016 when I was writing a column called Blacks for Trump, back when people were saying black people weren't going to be voting for Trump for the election. And I was set out to find out if that was true. And I found quite a few African-Americans who were planning to vote for Trump. And she was one of them. Everyone was like, you got to talk to Daphne. And now Daphne is running, has been picked by the Republican Party to run against Jim Kenney. Wow.
And, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and it was kind of touch and go for a little bit because she got the endorsement actually last week. And after the word kind of got out and spread, apparently there was some back and forth as to whether or not she was the best candidate. And there was a special meeting called Monday night where the Philly GOP got together, and I wasn't there. I don't know what happened, but I know they ended up allowing Daphne to keep her endorsement. So she is the candidate who will be running against Mayor Jim Kenney. This is her first political run. She's a longtime ward leader. She's a graduate of Girls High. She's a single mom. She's got three sons who've all gone to college and done well. She's a grandmother. She's on disability. That was one of the issues some people in the GOP were pointing to, like, hey, how can she run for mayor if she's on disability? And she says, hey, if I win, I'll get off of it. She's quite an interesting woman. I wrote a column about her that ran in the paper on Saturday. It's available if you Google it, philly.com and Daphne Goggins, G-O-G-G-I-N-S, and maybe my last name. It'll pop up pretty easily. She's a fascinating woman. She's not like most people you see. I described her in my piece as sort of being like that relative who shows up at Thanksgiving, who says contrary and outrageous political things, but you love them and accept them because they're family. That's Daphne all the way. She and I don't agree on anything, especially that damn MAGA hat she loves. She's got a red MAGA Make America Great Again baseball cap.
Well,
she loves it.
Well,
and she loves herself some Donald Trump.
Oh, so you can't be a Donald Trump supporter without a MAGA hat. I think that's kind of like
a rule.
MAGA
hat. I think she's got more than one. But, you know, this is America. People get to think whatever they want, have whatever views they want. And I'm able to separate her political views from Daphne, the person. I find her to be very warm, very engaging. And I didn't like it when they were talking about removing her from the ballot. I thought she won. This is her big break in life. You know, they're not going to win anyway. She's no threat to Jim Kenney. I don't think they had anyone who could unseat Jim Kenney. You know, the Democrats outnumber the Republicans in this town 7-1. It ain't going to happen. So I think they were wise to let her remain because the Republicans talk big talk about wanting to reach out to minorities. And this is a way to kind of show, hey, to wave the, you know, a multicolored flag, so to speak, and say, hey, we're inclusive. So if they had unseated Daphne, they would have had big trouble in the future. So they were smart to allow her to keep that position. that endorsement, and we all know what's going to happen in the fall. But deep down inside, I hope she does well. I think she could benefit from some media coaching, and she's a nice lady. She's definitely made the race a lot more interesting.
Okay, well, we've reached out to her to try to get her on the show to find out about what she stands for and what she hopes to do. What I found most interesting about that whole thing was her opponent, Billy Cingolini, was the one that, brought up the whole, disability thing. And the thing is, it's not like the mayor of Philadelphia is running around, lifting a lot of heavy boxes. That's kind of not what he does or what she does. And it's not like, the mayor of Philadelphia is, toting barges or lifting bales or anything that would make being clinically disabled, something that would be a problem. Being the mayor is more of a mental job. It involves more, thinking and planning and doing things like that. So I think you can think and plan even if you, even if you can't lift heavy boxes. So I never, understood what that was. And apparently, according to my sources, they had another black woman that was kind of waiting in the wings in case
really?
They did decide to rescind this endorsement, because having, giving the endorsement to another black woman would have kind of saved them from, hey, you're a racist charges. And the thing is, let's face it. One of the things that Ms. Goggins Jenkins is going to find out the hard way is that the Republican Party has no money to help her win. And I say this because every other candidate that they've put up for mayor or any other seat, they don't have their own money. They don't get any money from the party. And the National Party is focused more on Congress and state legislatures. They're not necessarily going to give a big pot of money to a city like Philadelphia, where they know that it's highly unlikely that their candidate is going to do well. So, what gets me is you're endorsing this person, but you're not putting any money behind it. And let's face it, if you're going to take an endorsement from somebody, they've got to be willing to support you in some way, either with, troops to get the vote out, or people to get your message out, or with some money to help, help you get posters and different things. And if they're not doing that, then their endorsement isn't worth the paper it's printed on. And unfortunately, for most of the Republican mayoral candidates, with the exception of Sam Katz back in the early 2000s, and he was their best bet, but he was also able to raise his own money because the party really doesn't have any. So, it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out within the Republican Party itself, because they still have a primary too. And from what I understand, Mr. Cingolini isn't going away despite not getting the endorsement. Now, in terms of the 190th district, the people running for the special election to fill the unexpired term of Vanessa Lowry Brown are Movita Johnson-Harrell, who was on earlier in the 7 o'clock hour, Michael Harvey, who's running as a Republican, Amin Brown, who you just heard from before we went to break, and Pamela Williams of the Working Families Party. So those are your choices for the March 12th special election, and hopefully folks will make a point to get out and vote, because that's important. And you can't complain about having bad representation if you're not, putting your 2 cents in about that representation. You have to be willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those elections where your vote really matters more than ever. Sometimes people say, my vote doesn't count. There's so many people voting. What difference does it make whether I vote? You vote in this election. Your vote is definitely going to count. You bring your family with you, bring your friends, and spread the word, because it matters, folks.
Well, we're getting set up for our next guest. Temple University's College of Education is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year, and they're doing it with a series of high-powered speakers who are going to be talking about various things regarding education. And we're going to be setting up in a minute to speak with one of these speakers who's just walking into the studio right now, but I need you guys to come around to where we can see you on Facebook Live. In fact, how about if we take a quick break so we can set that up? We'll be back in a moment with more of Mark and Denise in the Mornings.
I am a mother.
I am an entrepreneur.
I am a singer.
I am an artist.
I'm a journalist.
A businesswoman.
An educator.
A sister.
A grandmother.
An advocate.
A leader.
I am a friend.
I am.
I am.
I am.
I am.
I am.
I am.
I am one of more than a million people living with HIV in the U.S.
We are not alone. Let's stop HIV together.
Get the facts. Get tested. Get involved. Go to www.actagainstaids.org for more information.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness. From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Thanks for listening to Mark and Denise in the Mornings. And Denise, thanks for holding it down while I'm out today. I want to also thank our special guest host and all of you. Listen, as you know, we're in the middle of a funding campaign to keep Mark and Denise in the Mornings on air. If you don't want this to disappear, I suggest you do something about it. Find us at GoFundMe. Look for Mark and Denise in the Mornings or hashtag Mad in the Mornings. We're not mad at you, just MND. Hashtag Mad in the Mornings at GoFundMe.com and contribute whatever you like. Also, you can find us on Cash App or PayPal at Tyler Made Media. And if you are old school and you just want to write a check, you know, so-called check is in the mail, go to P.O. Box 25843. Again, P.O. Box 25843, Philadelphia 19128. Address it to Tyler Made Media, LLC. Thanks, you all. Keep on listening.
And we're back. This is Denise Clay, and you're listening to Mark and Denise in the Mornings on WWDBAM 860. And, I'm being joined today by our special guest host, Janice Armstrong, columnist at with the Philadelphia Daily News and Philly.com. And in the studio with me right now is Charles Hamilton Houston III. I mentioned before we went to break that Temple University is celebrating its 100th anniversary as a as an educational institution in terms of the College of Education, and to sell and to, you know, help celebrate that, they are bringing in a group of speakers that are here to talk to us about, you know, different aspects of education and certain things that we, you know, need to continue to look at. And one of those things is, you know, I guess for want of a better way to put it, the resegregation of our public schools. Because if you remember, you know, back in the 60s, thanks to the Brown versus Board of Education decision, you know, schools were desegregated, at least legally.
Right.
So now we're kind of moving in the other direction, and which makes our next guest, you know, someone that, you know, I kind of wanted to talk to. He's Charles Hamilton Houston III, and he is your great-grandfather?
My grandfather.
Your grandfather was one of the people who was instrumental in getting Brown v. Board of Education to the Supreme Court and decided in a way where students could all attend the schools they wanted to attend, regardless of race. And I'm glad that you came in. And he's going to be speaking at the Barnes Foundation tomorrow night as part of Temple University's 125th anniversary. So, you know, is it 125th or 100th?
It's 100th anniversary.
I know. I'm having one of those mornings where my brain is only half working, and And part of it is because I haven't had any coffee, but I'm going to take care of that as soon as I get out of here. But thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And joining him is the Director of Development for the College of Education at Temple University, a job I do not envy you. and because, again, my brain is not your name.
I'm Grace Greenwich.
Yes.
I'm Assistant Dean of Development and Alumni Relations for the College of Education. And I actually enjoy my work. It's quite a bit of fun. I feel good raising scholarships and helping to build programs that help to build access for education for our young people.
Okay. And most of the city of Philadelphia's teachers come from Temple University. So if you're a teacher, and I know that there are teachers who are probably sitting and listening to this morning because they're not in school, you know, here is the person that you need to talk to about how you can better contribute to your university's educational programs. So, Mr. I guess I should start by asking you, you know, when your grandfather sat down and talked to you about Brown versus Board of Education, what did he tell you that experience was like?
Well, let me just sort of provide a bit of background on the timing here. My grandfather actually passed in 1950, well before I was born. And, in fact, my father was only a small child. So I never had the privilege of meeting him personally and spending time with him. But, you know, obviously my father had some memories of his dad. And I've had the great privilege of getting to meet and talk to some amazing lions of the civil rights movement who knew him and worked with him. Mm-hmm. People like Judge Robert Carter, people like Thurgood Marshall, and so on. And in fact, I worked for as a law clerk for Judge Damon J. Keith on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, who was a law student at Howard when my grandfather and Thurgood were doing mock arguments in the mock courtroom.
Wow. So, in terms of your family and this legacy, how did that impact how education was communicated to you, the importance of it, and why it was important?
Well, so there's no question that my grandfather's achievements spurred the hunger for education within my family, but it actually even predated him. My grandfather, though he was born in 1895, his father was a lawyer in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., and this was back before black folks could even attend law school, and so he read law and apprenticed and worked his way up past the bar and set up his own practice in D.C., and so going back on my dad's side, three generations. It's always been critical, and that's how my grandfather got to Amherst, got to Harvard, and went on to, you know, devote his career to creating access to education.
When you look at the educational landscape now, again, we're talking about how schools are becoming resegregated, and here in Philadelphia, the school district, to be generous, has been a hot mess for a while because I always tell people because I cover politics now, but I started out covering education, and I've always believed that teachers and politicians know just enough about what each other does to be dangerous, but not enough to be effective. Mm-hmm. And because of that, kids who are the main people who we're supposed to be concerning ourselves with in terms of education are the ones that are sitting there, you know, getting beaten around because you have these two groups of people who really should know about more about what each other does, and yet they don't. In terms of what you're seeing in terms of the educational landscape now, again, are you seeing some of the resegregation, and what can we do to combat that?
Oh, I wish there were an easy answer for that. Absolutely, I'm seeing it. I mean, there are those who argue that Brown was a failure. I don't subscribe to that theory, but there mm-hmm. are those who say that if the aim of Brown was to desegregate public education, then by today's metrics, we have to regard it as a failure. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't subscribe to that particular point of view. I think that Brown had a bigger, larger, broader cause and broader purpose than just education, because after all, what we're talking about is, you know, though the Brown case was about education, what we're talking about is Brown being the first major case that did away with segregation in public accommodations. Mm-hmm. And so today, in my particular view, Brown stands for the proposition that, you know, Plessy v. Ferguson's doctrine of separate but equal is dead in every respect. And so to your question about what can we do, I think we have to realize that, you know, today's segregation in public schools is vastly different than that, you know, than pre-1954. That was segregation by law. This is segregation really by economics. Right. Mm-hmm. Because the segregation that we're seeing today is the result of things like white flight, Catholic schools, the building of suburbs and indeed exurbs as people flee further and further away trying to get, you know, what they perceive to be good schools for their children.
And the thing is, when you look at that, even now some of the suburbs are dealing with some of those same problems in terms of education. And people wanting to go further out and kind of running away. And also the money problem, how we finance education. And that's something that it seems like no one wants to talk about.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, public schools are financed through property taxes, right? The schools in the wealthier areas tend to have more resources, lower student-teacher ratios, better facilities, better equipment. Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated, complex issue. And I like I said, I wish I had an easy answer for you.
But I just want to, you know, go back to something that you had mentioned, Charles. Brown v. Board of Education made it possible for us to continue to address inequity in access. I look at the College of Education's Institute on Disabilities. It was able to partner with Pennsylvania to expand access for those with disabilities to have access to education. So again, Brown versus Board of Education has made it possible, that case made it possible for us to continue to address access and accommodations.
So what can organizations like Temple University that prepare our teachers, what can they do to kind of help with this? Because I know that one of the problems that Temple and the community surrounding it have had is there's this perception that Temple could be doing more for the community, and yet it's not. And I don't know if it's an accurate perception, but it's the perception that a lot of people have.
Well, let me say this. I can speak for the College of Education's mm-hmm. ongoing commitment to its neighborhoods and our parents and those that are surrounding our campus. We have a plethora of programs that we've partnered with, not just with the school district, but with teachers, with families in the area. Programs that I'm not sure everyone is cognizant of, like our Temple Education Scholars Program, an excellent dual enrollment program that allows students in their junior year to come in and take college courses. What separates our program from other programs is the fact that our students come in, they come on campus to learn, we provide them with admissions training, we provide them with information about financial literacy, about the financial aid process. So very different from most dual enrollment programs. So when students go through our program, they are well aware of doing well, how to do well when they get to college. But we've not just started there. We have an Urban Youth Leadership Academy program that admits both young men and young women into the program in the middle school, and we stay with them. We provide them with tutoring and mentoring that will take them straight through college. And Dean Anderson is committed to finding additional resources to help fund those students that are coming through these programs to have access and greater scholarships to go through the program. And that's just a couple of the programs. I've not talked about our intergenerational center, which brings together seniors with the young people who are right surrounding our neighborhoods, so that they can learn from the guidance and the wisdom of those who are older and get tutoring and mentoring so they can do well in school. Those are some of the real concrete things that we're doing in the community.
Okay. Now, what are you going to be sharing with folks tomorrow at the Barnes Foundation when you speak about this?
So I'm going to talk about the genesis or the origin of Brown, how it came to be. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about the test cases leading up to Brown. I'll talk about the decision itself. And then I'll talk a bit about the legacy of Brown, where we are, the different criticisms and praises of Brown. And I think it's important to understand that Brown was not perfect, but it was never intended to be. Brown was intended to be the first brick of, you know, of the foundation for equality. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. And for its time, for what it was perfect, but it was the execution and the implementation of the desegregation that was the problem. And what I'll be talking about is the limits that courts have in terms of being able to legislate from the bench and in terms of being able to effect social change from the bench. Judges don't do that. We do that.
And that was kind of, you know, my next question, because when, I mean, desegregation has in at times been met with violence. All you have to do is look at the situation in Boston when school desegregation happened. I mean, you had people attacking buses of kids because they did not want those kids coming to their schools. So when you look at stuff like that, and you're right, you know, Brown was supposed to be a brick, you know, it kind of seemed like, for want of a better way to put it, that brick was being thrown through a window.
That's a terrible but apt analogy. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'll be talking about is, and you mentioned sort of people's reaction, their visceral reaction to their kids attending integrated schools. One of the things I'll be talking about in sort of the lead up to Brown, part of the strategy that my grandfather implemented was based on the fact that he knew that people would react viscerally to the idea of their young children, a little young white Sally, going to school with, you know, with black boys. And so the strategy of Brown started in the 1930s, and the first cases that were brought at the graduate and professional school level, the idea being that they were going to take a top-down approach and lay some foundation, create some precedent at the law school and graduate school level, mm-hmm. and slowly lay the trail, slowly lead up to the ultimate goal, which was desegregation of public education in all American schools.
Okay. Janice, did you have any questions?
Yes, I'm curious about tomorrow, the program. Is it free? What time does it start? Who can go? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, we'd love to see the, you know, a good number of people there. We think it's an important program. Feel free to contact our office, and we'll do everything that we can to accommodate folks. We do have limited seating. We do have a great deal of attendance. But if you would like to come, please give us a call at 215-204-4649, and we'll do everything
that we can. Can you repeat the number? I didn't have my pen ready.
Sure. It's 215-204-4649, and we'll do everything that we can to accommodate you. Please give us a call.
And also, it kind of works that you're doing this at the Barnes Foundation, which is this collection of art that was at one time co-owned by Lincoln University, one of the HBCUs here in Pennsylvania. They had people on their board from that were members of the Barnes Foundation, and they got assistance for their educational programs through the Barnes Foundation before it moved down here, because it was in suburban Philadelphia in, like, somebody's house, and it was actually pretty cool. But you know, you couldn't really see all of it. Now you can.
Denise, I did not know that.
Well, I am nothing if not a fountain of totally interesting information that sometimes is useful and sometimes is not. I think we have a call. Someone won, and one of our regular callers' name is Timothy Hanna. Thank you for joining us, Timothy. Did you have a question?
Denise, you're doing a great job, and I miss Denise Armstrong, especially what's going on with Colin Kaepernick. You also have an administrator here from Temple, and your grandfather and your great grandfather is a hero of mine, man. I'm a Lincoln University graduate. And we talked about Thurgood Marshall, but we were later introduced to Charles Hamilton Houston and your grandfather, William. So I'm honored. I am honored to be able to talk to the offspring of that because Groundwork was one of my favorite books by your grandfather. And we talked about your grandfather's work, but we talked about him and his social engineers, who he taught from Howard University to go out in the field. And your grandfather always made the comment that if you're not working as a social advocate for the community as a lawyer, then you're a parasite.
That's right.
So, wow.
That's right. That's right. So when men like that came along, they were from Lincoln and Cheney and Howard.
Howard.
That's not made anymore. I mean, you know, we go way back. You have the Mozells and the Grimkes who came out of that group of men, the talented 10th, who graduated in 1870 and 1875. You say they made it like that with unbelievable circumstances. And people don't know the history of Thurgood Marshall. Like you said, education from segregation, not wanting us in schools to matriculate, started at a high level. Thurgood Marshall, after coming out of Lincoln University, applied to the University of Maryland as a rejected. And as a result of it, he came to Howard. That branded him. He said, I got to do something about this on a high level to a low level. So, I mean, one day I'd like to be able to meet you, man, because I have a lot to talk about your father, your grandfather, that era, and groundwork. It's a pleasure to at least talk to you on the phone.
Well, likewise, the pleasure is mine, and what I'd like to do is figure out a way for us to exchange information, and you and I can stay in touch offline. I'm happy to do that. happy to do that and talk to you anytime. And can I tell you, I'm so impressed that you know not just of my grandfather, but his dad William. That's pretty rare. In my view, and it's admittedly a biased one. In my view, Houston is one of the most important, not just lawyers, but one of the most important figures of the 20th century. And, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned his quote, which is that a lawyer is either a social engineer or a parasite on society. Because what he did was, in addition to sort of laying the foundation for Brown, I would make the argument that his most lasting impression was the transformation of Howard Law School from a part-time, unaccredited law school into a full-time academy producing the very best young, brilliant minds and constitutional scholars who went on to do the work.
Wow.
I'm going to tell you something, sir, before I let you go, that people always bragged about Harvard's constitutional law program. But the people who really know, if you want to study constitutional law, you go to Howard.
That's exactly
because
right.
of your grandfather. Well, you know, so I'm happy like a person like you came on because we need to know this, the foundation of this, what it did and where we are today. And we need people like your grandfather and your father and the Thurgood Marshall and the Johnny Cochran and all those people, man, that one time did something, we need the same thing done today.
Well, I hope you'll be able to join us at the Barnes Foundation tomorrow. I mean, you'd get to meet him there.
What time? What time, man? What time?
5:30 p.m.
What's the fee? What's the fee?
You know what? You would join us as a guest. We'd love to have you.
Oh, 5:30. Listen, I'm honored. Let me tell you something. This radio program is doing a great thing in Philadelphia.
Well, thank you.
Doing a good job, Denise. You and the rest. And Denise Armstrong, you got to come back because we got a lot to talk about. Okay.
Well, thank you.
I'd love to see you too one of these days.
And Jason, what? Could you do me a favor and grab Timothy's contact information so I can give it to Mr. Houston? Thank you. Thank you so much. And the thing is, you know, your grandfather made a good point that if you were not, it's kind of like if you're not a part of the solution, you're a part of the problem. And I guess how do we get more people to want to be a part of the solution in this particular case? Because let's face it, education is the great equalizer. And part of the reason why you had a black middle class that rose up from the 60s in the first place was because of the access that we got to education, particularly higher education. So I guess how do we get people to understand this importance and to work toward getting us a little closer to where Brown wanted us to be by now anyway?
Yeah, I think what we do there is, I think to get the message across today, to today's generation, we have to look backwards a little bit and make the point to them that you just made, which was that education is the great equalizer, and look how previous generations used it to get where we are today. Look at the stark contrast, the stark difference between where we are today as a people and where we were pre-1954. Is it perfect? No. Have we made great advancements? Absolutely. Those advancements are tied in large part to the equal access, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I'll be talking about tomorrow is, you know, in addition to eliminating Plessy v. Ferguson's separate but equal doctrine, the other thing Brown did, at least in large part, was to provide a spark to the civil rights movement.
Wow.
Right. That was huge. And, you know, I think people, the farther we get away from it, I think the more people forget of how unequal things were, how separate and how awfully unequal. People forget the fact that you had to walk past the white school to get to the black school in many cases, or that you couldn't have a new book. You only got a new books at your school when the kids from the white schools got, you know, were finished with them. That's when you got books. How it wasn't just your school was here and their school was there. Things were drastically unequal. You could have, your parents could pay and be taxpayers and help support the white school, but you had no chance of going to that elementary school, the junior high school, the high school. Am I wrong? I think the farther away we get, the less of a realization there is of just how unequal the situation was.
Absolutely. And I think we almost forget that we had a stronger sense of community among ourselves. I remember growing up and having someone who took care of me when we were young people while my parents were at work. And we'd be out on our porch and we'd be studying, and she'd invite other young people in the community in on our block to just come up on a porch and do math with my sister, brother, and I. And I think that's part of the missing link we're missing, you know, during that time, in a time where we did not have access by law, we came together more as a neighborhood and among ourselves to support each other and to be there in an intergenerational level to support young people. And I think we have to get back to that.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for coming in. And this event is happening at the Barnes Foundation tomorrow night, starting at 5:30.
Yes.
We'll post the information on how you can come out on the Mark and Denise in the Mornings Facebook page. So that way, if anybody wants to come out, they can. I'm a member of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists, and Dawn Jones Roberts, who's like awesome in more ways than we can actually calculate, was kind enough to send us some information on how our members can participate.
Yes.
in tomorrow night's presentation. So I'll probably be there because, yes, while I cover politics, I still keep my toe in education because I'm hoping to at some point help educators and politicians no longer be danger, just enough to be dangerous, but to actually be able to work on these issues effectively. And this is part of the Temple University's College of Education's 100th anniversary.
Yes.
And I guess, are there more programs like this to come?
Absolutely. We will have a part two to this program.
Oh, really?
We will actually, yes, we do need to reschedule it in light of the weather conditions.
Uh-huh.
And, so we're going to put it in a warmer time frame of the year.
Warmer is good.
Yes. This is the 65th anniversary of Brown. And so we're also going to, in part two of the program, talk more about what's been happening in the Philadelphia school system with some who were part of the desegregation movement right here in Philadelphia. Also, on March 1st, we're having the Institute on Disabilities will be doing a production of A Fierce Kind of Love at the Fringe Arts Theater, and tickets are online, and I'll get the information to you about folks can purchase tickets.
The Institute on Disabilities at Temple University has a special place in my heart, because when I was the media liaison for the College of Education, I did a lot of work with them. My late older brother was developmentally disabled, so I really paid attention to the stuff that they were doing, because it was the kind of stuff that, you know, we ended up kind of doing on our own in our house, but kind of wished that, you know, we had had access to more of this kind of stuff, and because they do a really outstanding job.
They really do. They have a dynamic executive director, Celia Feinstein, mm-hmm. and earlier I mentioned the work with Brown and how Brown was able to open up access. And it was her offices that worked very closely with Pennsylvania to open up access through Brown versus Board of Education for those with disabilities. And the college could not be more proud to have the Institute of Disabilities right here in our College of Education.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much for coming in. It was great. It was great to see you again, and it was great to meet you.
It's been a pleasure.
And hopefully folks will come out, because we won't know where we're going until we talk a little bit more about where we've been.
Absolutely.
And one of the places where that discussion should start is with Brown v. Board of Education, because it kind of led to a lot of other things.
Yes.
So thank you both for coming in.
Yes.
And I really appreciate it, especially since, you know, we've been threatened with all kinds of weather craziness happening today. In fact, I was like, I hope they can get in before crap starts. But, again, thank you so much. And we're going to take a quick break because we have another candidate from the 190th district that's called in, and we want to, you know, kind of wrap up the program with that. But we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more with Mark and Denise in the mornings with my special guest host, Janice Armstrong, in a minute.
Thanks for listening to Mark and Denise in the mornings. And Denise, thanks for holding it down while I'm out today. I want to also thank our special guest host and all of you. Listen, as you know, we're in the middle of a funding campaign to keep Mark and Denise in the mornings on air. If you don't want this to disappear, I suggest you do something about it. Find us at GoFundMe. Look for Mark and Denise in the mornings or hashtag mad in the mornings. We're not mad at you, just MND. Hashtag mad in the mornings at GoFundMe.com. Contribute whatever you like. Also, you can find us on Cash App or PayPal at Tyler Made Media. And if you are old school and you just want to write a check, you know, so-called check is in the mail, go to P.O. Box 25843. Again, P.O. Box 25843, Philadelphia 19128. Address it to Tyler Made Media, LLC. Thanks, you all. Keep on listening.
And we're back. This is Denise Clay with Mark and Denise in the mornings. And my special guest host, Janice Armstrong, is still with us. Oh, I hope you're still with us.
Here.
And Pastor Pamela K. Williams, who is the working families candidate for the 190th district, has called in. And thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Janice, and good morning, Denise. Thank you so much for having me. I thought that I was one of the persons that followed the school children and rested a little bit this morning, but I got the word that you needed me, so I made sure that I called in. Thank you so kindly.
Well, thank you. In fact, I'm glad you called in, because, you know, this special election is coming up, and you're running on the Working Families Party ticket. Can you talk to us a little bit about what the Working Families Party is all about, and what made you decide to run, not only for the office, but under that banner?
Absolutely. The Working Families Party is a party that espouses the values of working families. The philosophy is that families have a right to a living wage. Families have a right to an adequate education. Families have a right to be able to grow and develop in this country in a positive stance of economic viability and educational leverage. And the Working Families Party is just a party that cares about people, and that's why I am aligned with them at this time. To just give you a little breakdown of what happened, I was one of the Democrats who was interviewed to receive the Democratic nomination when the other candidates were interviewed, and the Democrats subsequently chose Darrell Thomas. After Darrell Thomas was selected, I realized and knew unequivocally that I was the best candidate for the 190th representation in the legislature. Therefore, I partnered with the Working Families Party to make sure that I was on the ballot and that the citizens and residents of the 190th had an opportunity to choose someone who was laced with vision, integrity, structure, and accountability. I have a history, long history in the community. I have a long history in walking at the heels of my mother, Novella Williams, as she was a civil rights activist and a social justice warrior. So I've been at the heartbeat of the people. I've been walking and talking with the people. I've been advocating for the people. And I believe truly that progress starts with the people. And the opportunity came for me to run for the position of state representative. And I decided that because I knew that the people needed powerful representation to become a better community, I absolutely said, I will run, I need to run, and I need to be a part of this process. I am a lifelong Democrat. I was for 8 years the Democratic Executive Committee member for the 60th Ward, 16th Division, and I also served as the first vice chair of the ward. So I am historically a Democrat, but because I was not selected in the interview process, I partnered with Working Families Party, who I believe firmly shares my values and desires for the citizens of the 190th, so that I would be able to be on the ticket.
Okay, so what would you describe as your platform? I mean, what do you hope to do once you get to Harrisburg, if you win?
What I hope to do when I get to Harrisburg, the first focus is to make sure that the voice of the people resonates loud and clear in the state house. The issues that I will hold firm to is, I believe truly, in $15 minimum wage. I believe that anything less than that is immoral to a people who are represented, whether it be a commonwealth or a state government. I believe that everybody should be able to live free and unencumbered. I believe that raising the minimum wage to $15 will provide for people the ability to not only seed into their community, but to be able to live at a status where they feel good about themselves, where their morale is elevated to a place that they take care of the community, that they care about the community, and they feed into the community economically. Another issue that I want to focus on is fair funding for education. I'm a firm believer, not only because of my past activism, but my current activism and my past experience as a Philadelphia school police officer, that children in the Philadelphia school district have been neglected. I have a very hard time understanding why I had to go into a public school classroom in Philadelphia County and the children's teeth are chattering, their hands are cold, they have on gloves, and their feet are cold. But yet when I go in and visit Montgomery County or Bucks County or Chester County or schools in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, they have adequate heat, they have smart boards, they have textbooks,
and they have everything they need provided for them because of funding. And because of that disparity, it challenges our children. And not only that, it does not provide them the opportunity to be prepared to globally compete across this country. And I believe firmly that fair funding, if we could spend $50,000 to $57,000 on an inmate in the state of Pennsylvania and $12,000 on a student, that's just unconscionable and it's immoral. So those are the two issues and that I want to take very strongly to Harrisburg, and then universal health care and reforming mass incarceration. I believe firmly in ending mass incarceration. But as you end mass incarceration, you have to have the mindset of reforming mass incarceration. Because when those former inmates are released from the prison industrial complex, they must be trained, they must be sent and structured in educational situations that could cause them to get reacclimated in society and prevent recidivism. The problem is we release them. They have no birth certificate. They have no driver's license. They have no social security card. They don't even have the prospects of a job that will place them in a position to be able to care for themselves and their family who they have been disconnected with for some time. So those are four of the major issues that I plan on taking to Harrisburg and standing very firmly on.
Okay. Janice, do you have any questions?
Pastor Williams, I got your email when you were announcing that you're entering to the race. I don't know much about you, what church you're affiliated with. Tell us a little bit more about you, the person.
Thank you. I am a lifelong West Philadelphia resident, been living on 53rd Street all of my life. I cannot go away from any conversation without my understanding and my heritage. I take legacy prerogative. My mother was Novella Williams, a pioneering civil rights activist in the city of Philadelphia. Everything that I learned for social justice work and civil rights work was at her feet, walking with her, sitting in meetings with her, and listening and protesting with her. I myself have set out to continue that legacy through my own personal activism. I am the pastor of the Ark of Refuge Tabernacle, which is an inclusive congregation right now in University City who invites all who would want to serve God to come in and participate with us. My mantra that I hang my hat on is I have a love for God's people. And because I have a love for God's people, I come when I'm needed and I reach out into communities that are impoverished, disenfranchised, and where there is disparity. And I get on the front line. I use my voice to make sure that things are accomplished. For 22 years, we operated the Market Hall Bingo on 52nd and Market Street, which was a 501c affiliated. And what we did is we fed people. I remember so clearly the Thanksgiving baskets before it became popular with some of the powers now. We, every year, my mother and myself sought to feed 100 families. Because we understood that some families were not having Thanksgiving dinner together. And that has always been a place of collectiveness for my family. We always had to come together for Thanksgiving dinner. So we fed so many families, provided advocacy in reference to their electricity being cut off, the disparity with the gas company, disparate treatment with health care. My history is a long history. If people remember, then they know. One of the major things that I did was when Dr. Arlene Ackerman was forced to be removed from the Philadelphia School District as our superintendent. I took a position and a stand that I believe that the commissioners at that time were not empathizing with black and brown children and the negative impact that the disparate treatment of education was having on our communities of color.
Okay.
So I stood very okay.
I'm sorry. I had to, unfortunately, the out-cue music is telling me that I have to wrap things up right now.
But okay,
thank you,
okay.
But thank you so much for calling in, and we'll definitely have you back on. A big thank you to Janice Armstrong for holding it down with me today.
My pleasure. And what a great morning.
It has. And to people like Charles Hamilton Houston III and the folks from Temple University. And thank you, and have a good day, everybody.